What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama met at the Pentagon Thursday with top military and national security advisors to discuss the fight against the Islamic State group. He told reporters afterward, ISIL is losing ground in Syria and Iraq.
ISIL has not had a major successful offensive operation in either Syria or Iraq in a full year. Even ISIL's leaders know they're going to keep losing. In their message to followers, they're increasingly acknowledging that they may lose Mosul and Raqqa. And ISIL is right. They will lose them.
On another topic, the president told reporters Thursday that he is not confident that he can trust the Russians and their president, Vladimir Putin, to help the U.S. bring peace to Syria. The president said Russia may not be able to help end the violence, quoting now, either because they don't want to or because they don't have sufficient influence over Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, end of quote. Mr. Obama also denied that sending $400 million in cash to Iran on the same day as a hostage release last January was a ransom payment. And during a visit to Argentina Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry defended that move.
The United States of America does not pay ransom and does not negotiate ransoms with any country. We never have, and we're not doing that now.
John Kerry. Amid a scandal involving allegations of state-sponsored doping, the International Olympic Committee decided Thursday to allow more than 270 Russian athletes to compete in this summer's games. The decision came after a review of the athletes' doping records. Russia's original entry list included 389 names. An earlier ruling by the Court of Arbitration for Sport said the committee rules barring Russian athletes are unenforceable. This is VOA News. Taliban Thursday claimed responsibility for ambushing a group of U.S. and European tourists in Afghanistan's western Herat province, wounding six of the tourists and their Afghan driver. A provincial police spokesman says the attack took place in the Chishti Sharif area shortly after the tourists arrived from Bamyan province. The woman stabbed to death in an attack late Wednesday in London was the wife of a Florida State University psychology professor. London police say they have found no evidence to suggest that terrorism was a motive for the attack. They say mental health issues were involved when a man of Somali ancestry killed the woman and wounded five other people. New polling data show Democrat Hillary Clinton has the lead over Republican Donald Trump in four key states. The latest polls show Clinton opening a 9 percentage point edge in Michigan, a 15 point advantage in New Hampshire, an 11 point lead in Pennsylvania, and a 6 point lead in Florida. Clinton campaigned in Las Vegas, Nevada, and addressed the frustration of voters.
Maybe they're angry because there's a lot to be concerned about. We need to talk. We need to talk because we don't want you being sold the same bill of goods that the students who signed up to go to Trump University were sold.
Clinton's opponent, Donald Trump, spoke to a crowd of supporters in Maine and again promised a wall along the southern U.S. border to keep out illegal aliens.
We have border problems. People are pouring into our country. We have no idea who they are. We have people. We're going to build a wall, folks. Don't worry about it. We're going to build a wall.
Polls show Clinton has a larger but not insurmountable lead over Trump nationally. In an average of polls, Clinton is ahead of Trump by about 6 points. An impeachment committee in Brazil's Senate voted Thursday to hold a trial for suspended President Dilma Rousseff. The Senate itself will vote next Tuesday as to whether to begin a trial. Israel's Internal Security Agency says a senior official at an international aid organization has funneled millions of dollars of charity money to the Palestinian militant group Hamas. Shin Bet says Mohammed El-Halabi diverted up to $50 million from U.S.-based charity World Vision to Hamas, which used the money to build tunnels and buy arms. The Christian charity group said on its website that it was shocked by the allegations and has no reason to believe they are true. Ghana's Electoral Commission plans to reopen the national list of registered voters on Friday. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan opposition wants foreign troops as East African leaders meet today in Ethiopia to discuss the crisis.
If you need the peace agreement to go ahead and be implemented, you would need a third force to stay between the two forces so that the civilians and the peace agreement itself can be implemented without any problems.
Goy Yuyol is the SPLM in opposition representative to Ethiopia and the African Union. Zimbabweans living outside the country plan to shut down their country's borders through protest starting next Monday. Ghana's Electoral Commission will reopen the national voters list today, Friday. And South African voters rebuked the ruling ANC in Wednesday's local elections.
It has huge implications, I think, for governance in South Africa and for party politics.
Susan Boynton is professor of governance at the University of the Witwatersrand. Malawi President Mutharika missed the demands of protesting university students, and the postcard business is in northern Mali is thriving, even as tourism is at a standstill. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An official of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition says East African leaders meeting Friday in Ethiopia should endorse an intervention force for South Sudan to complement the UN peacekeeping force already in the country. President Salva Kiir has already said foreign troops are not necessary and their introduction will be a transgression. But Goy Yuyol, SPLM representative to Ethiopia and the African Union, says the peace agreement signed last year has collapsed following last month's clashes between rebel and government forces. Former rebel leader and former first vice president Riek Machar was replaced and has since been on the run. Yuyol says last month's clashes prove President Kiir is not in control of his forces.
Our position as SPLMIO is clear. We wanted a town to be pacified. You know, we realized that the government troops in Juba are doing despicable atrocities, raping women and killing people in town. The third force is a welcome, sir. A welcome for SPLMIO.
The president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir, said he does not see the need for any foreign intervention to come to South Sudan.
When we signed an agreement last year, we thought that the third force is not necessary, and we thought the two forces would manage the security in Juba. But with what happened in July 8th, 9th, and 11th, it could show you that the government of South Sudan or the president himself is not in control of his forces. If you need the peace agreement to go ahead and be implemented, you would need a third force to stay between the two forces so that the civilians and the peace agreement itself can be implemented without any problems.
Let me ask you, is your leader, Riek Machar, is he going to be in Addis Ababa?
We hope that he would be here, but since he was pushed out of Juba, he's still around Juba. He's being attacked daily by government troops and helicopters, and we did not find a way for him to get out.
So you are saying he is in South Sudan?
Yes, he's in South Sudan, it's around Juba.
And you said that he's being attacked daily, but we've spoken with the government, and we were told that the government had never gone after Riek Machar.
You know, we have UN people in Juba, and every morning you see helicopters taking off and soldiers moving towards the directions where they suspected Dr. Riek Machar to be hiding. And guns I heard, there's a lot of fighting. This thing is not something somebody can deny. And I'm just wondering why the government is doing that. There were directives to hunt for Dr. Machar, and it's happening daily.
You said the SPLMIO would like for the peace process to get back to where it was before the July fighting. Is it possible because, as you know, the first vice president, Riek Machar, has been replaced? So is it possible that you can ever get back to that?
You know, we know that the position of installing Taban Dengai to be the first vice president was illegal. If you could follow what happened in Juba, they were saying that Dr. Machar was absent and they're replacing him temporarily. But if they're replacing him temporarily, it would be Dr. Machar himself selecting a senior minister to replace him. But what actually happened in Juba is a replacement. And that replacement was illegal because the leadership of SPLMIO did not sit down. We have 28 members of Politburo of SPLMIO. Only four people sat down in Juba. And that's why this agreement became null and void. You know, they've actually abrogated the whole agreement, and the agreement was dead. For us to go back to Juba, we need the peace agreement to come back to where it was. We at SPLM-IO believe that the agreement itself is the only thing that will save South Sudanese. We want all these things that have been installed illegally to be returned back to where they were before July 8th.
Goi Yuyol is the SPLM in opposition representative to Ethiopia and the African Union. He was speaking with me from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Results from Wednesday's South African municipal elections showed the ruling African National Congress Party, the ANC, winning a majority of seats, but getting a strong rebuke from voters in major metropolitan areas. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Election results released Thursday show South African voters turning away from the long-dominant African National Congress Party in large numbers and denying them an outright win in major urban areas. The ANC, the party credited with leading South Africa out of apartheid, will continue to hold more local government seats than any other party. But this election has yielded decisive gains by the opposition Democratic Alliance, especially in metropolitan areas like Johannesburg, the economic hub, Pretoria, the capital, and the seaside city of Port Elizabeth. The DA already holds the city of Cape Town and surrounding Western Cape Province. The far-left economic freedom fighters also made gains nationally, but not enough to dominate any major urban areas. Voters said they were dismayed by numerous scandals within the ANC, the corruption allegations that persistently swirl around President Jacob Zuma, and the enduring inequality and unemployment that they feel the ANC has not remedied since it came to power in 1994. Susan Boyson is a professor of governance at the University of the Witwatersrand and author of Dominance and Decline, the ANC in the Time of Zuma. She says this local election could have major effects in the future.
It has huge implications, I think, for governance in South Africa and for party politics. It probably means, in the first place, that the ANC would be necessitated, forced to step back and reflect on how they will be approaching national and provincial elections in 2019.
That's when the nation will return to the polls for national elections. President Zuma's second and final term ends in 2019. In the meantime, the opposition parties will have a chance to show their mettle. But Boyson notes they may still be under the thumb of the ANC.
It is inevitable that there will be coalition governments. In some of these cities where even the ANC and the DA in most of these metro cities remain only the second biggest party after the ANC.
But it is clear the ruling party has been given a wake-up call. And many critics say the ANC's fall from grace can be directly attributable to one man. Perhaps there is no greater example of President Zuma's unpopularity as one small set of results the Election Commission released on Thursday. The president hails from the rural town of Nkandla, where he remodeled a family home using about $20 million in government funds. As of Thursday, the ANC controls Nkandla no more. President Zuma's party soundly lost his hometown to the relatively obscure Inkatha Freedom Party. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Ghana's Electoral Commission will today, Friday, reopen the National Register voters list so that tens of thousands of people whose names were deleted because of a problem with their identification documents can re-register for the December general election. The country's Supreme Court had ordered the commission to delete from the registry anyone who had applied to vote using a National Health Insurance Scheme card because the card is not a valid proof of identity for voting purposes. Electoral Commission spokesman Eric Zapasu says the commission met with the Inter-Party Advisory Committee to discuss re-registering the disqualified voters.
Today, Friday, we are mopping up those who registered with the NHIS card, and the Supreme Court ordered that we should delete and then give them the opportunity to re-register so that they can vote in this year's elections. We deleted about 56,772 names, and then we gave them the opportunity from the 18th to the 28th of July to register. At the completion of that exercise, 24,287 were able to register, leaving a backlog of about 32,300 plus to register. So upon engagement with the stakeholders, it has become very compelling to mop up the rest of the people who are left and couldn't register.
So does that mean that there will be a one-week extension window by which individuals who have yet to register can participate and register to enable them to be part of the voter register that will be used for the election?
Yes, exactly that. We are targeting a specific group of people. And these are those people who use the NHIS card to register, and which the Supreme Court ordered that we should delete them because it isn't valid to use the NHIS card to register. So we should delete them and give them the opportunity to register. So we finished the first phase, which was a 10-day exercise, and the backlog is left, and that is what we are mopping up now by giving this extension of 1 week from this morning, 5th of August, to the 12th of August.
What about the voter register itself to be used for the election? Those who were unable to register, will there be a continuous process by the Electoral Commission to try to register them before the election based on the electoral law that guides the Electoral Commission?
Thank you very much. The arrangement is that there's going to be 2 days for the continuous voters registration. And that will be on the 19th of August and then on the 26th of August. What this means is that all persons who have never registered from 2012 up to 2016 will now have this opportunity to register either on the Friday 19th of August or 26th of August.
The acting national chairman of the opposition New Patriotic Party has stated that the party is not happy with moves by the Electoral Commission to opt for the Electronic Results Transmission System, the ERTS, for the December 7 polls. What is your reaction to this statement coming from the acting chairman of the main opposition party?
You know, after the election petition of 2013, civil society, political parties, Electoral Commission came out with a number of reform proposals. To get these proposals working, the Inter-Party Advisory Committee, the Civil Society, Electoral Commission set up an Electoral Reform Committee. This committee came out with some 27-point reforms. Significant among these reforms was the Electronic Results Transmission System. All the political parties, including the MPP, endorsed it. Thus, the substance of this reform is that after the elections, all polling station results will be brought to the collation center. When these results are entered onto the collation sheet, it will be signed by all party agents together with the Electoral Commission. This results collation sheet will be scanned and electronically transmitted to the National Collation Center at the capital, Accra, for the counting and declaration of the presidential results.
Ghana's Electoral Commission spokesman Eric Zapasu was speaking with reporter Peter Clotty from Accra. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, August 5th. Let's send a shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Diamond FM, in Tamale, Ghana. Daybreak Africa time is 18 minutes past the hour. Zimbabweans living outside the country are planning to shut down their country's borders beginning Monday to protest the government's move to block the importation of some basic commodities. The government says the ban will boost the production of local goods. One of the coordinators of the protest, Joseph Chanakira of the Citizens of Zimbabwe movement based in South Africa, said the protest will take place in South Africa, Botswana, Zambia, Mozambique, and Tanzania, and will continue until the Zimbabwe government reverses the importation ban.
We are going to be protesting at all borders across around Zimbabwe to try and send a clear message to the government about the way they are treating the people through the introduction of Statutory 64 of 2016.
Who are you working with?
We are working with Tajamuka. We are working with International Cross Borders Association. We are working with the bus operator organizations. We are working with movements of citizens. We are working with the Zimbabwe Exiles Forum. We are working with all interested political parties, which I will not mention at this point in time. Our major demand is that the ZANU-PF government, which is led by Robert Gabriel Mugabe, must consider or actually abolish, to use the correct term, through our statutory instrument 64 of 2016.
So now, are you engaging the respective governments, you know, in the countries where you want to stage the protests?
Yes, we have done that through the various mechanisms provided by the respective constitutions.
And what are the governments saying about this? And are you getting any other support from civic society organizations?
We are getting new, should I say, intensive or maximum support from civic organizations. We are involving student movements in the various countries, and they are all responding positively.
How sustainable is this kind of mass protest?
We are going to sustain it. Remember, the borders into Zimbabwe, the primary or are the most important areas when we look in terms of the economy and the free movement of goods and people. So if we get there and we are able to organize a march and protest and get it to shut down for a day or two, we believe that that will be a matter of sending a clear message, and we are going to sustain it because we have the numbers. The people are coming on board.
Are combi operators and bus operators willing to actually sacrifice their business for that?
They are willing because they are losing the most. Remember, buses would normally have a trailer carrying staff, and they would charge prices for that. And Omalaicha, they do the same thing. They carry staff to Zim. But now all that business is going away due to the instrument.
Is the Zimbabwean government aware of what you're doing?
I'm not really concerned because these protests will not be carried out on Zimbabwean soil.
That was Joseph Chanakira of Citizens of Zimbabwe Movement speaking from Johannesburg with Gabe Dube of VOA Zimbabwe program. In Malawi, President Peter Mutharika has met the demands of civil society and students of the University of Malawi who have been protesting the recent hike in university tuition. Earlier yesterday, the protesters took to the streets in the country's four major cities. Lamek Masina reports for VOA from Malawi's commercial capital, Blantyre.
Protesters carried banners and sang songs denouncing the new tuition fee, which the university council raised by over 100%. The university said the hike was to help pay for improvements in higher education. That included higher salaries for lecturers who have been boycotting their low pay. The protesters said this was unreasonable. Comrade Dimayuni of the University Students' Union led the protesters in Blanta.
The concern among students is that the fee hike is just too high, such that a number of students, majority of them, cannot afford to pay such amount of money. So we are here to petition the president to consider our grievances so that the fees should be below the amount which has been put.
The nationwide protest coincided with a meeting in Lilongwe between Malawi President Peter Mutharika, who is the Chancellor of the University of Malawi, and the representatives of the UMSU, the University Students' Union.
There are many ways of resolving a conflict. You can resolve it through demonstrations. That's why we have also taken another step, apart from the one which has been taken by UMSU representatives.
For nearly a month, the students tried to push government authorities to negotiate the fees. 2 weeks ago, the protesting students at Chancellor College of the University of Malawi blocked the convoy of a visiting U.S. government official, the visiting wife of the U.S. Vice President Joe Biden. The government apologized to Mrs. Biden and also closed the Chancellor College. In their petition, the protesters also demanded the immediate reopening of the college. So far, the government has not announced when the school will reopen. Francis Matewere received the petition on behalf of the chief executive of Blantyre City Assembly.
I would like to assure all of you, the civil society and all other stakeholders, that this petition that has been received today will be delivered to the appropriate authority, and in this case, Office of the President and Cabinet.
In a swift response to the call, President Mutharika has reduced the fee by at least 5%, a move which has pleased the students. The protest, named hashtag Unima Fee Must Fall, were poorly attended in all the cities of Unzuzu, Lilongwe, Zomba, and Blantyre. For example, in Blantyre, there were only 4 protesters, and they were outnumbered by nearly 50 police officers, most of them heavily armed. In other cities, there were not more than 200 protesters. Organizers said this is largely because some of the colleges are closed and most of the students remained at home. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
continuing conflict in northern Mali has decimated tourism, a key local industry. But in Timbuktu, the postcard business is on the upswing. Out-of-work tour guides are earning money with a website that allows people anywhere in the world to send a stamped postcard from the iconic desert outpost. Katerina Hoyer has the story from Timbuktu.
Timbuktu's post office lacks both windows and doors. The only furniture inside a low brick building is a desk for the city's only postman, Osman Ali Umaiga. Mail piles up in the adjoining room. Letters, bills, debt collection demands. So many residents fled when conflict began in 2012. Maiga, the director of the post office, says, "We have been abandoned by the state. For a long time, I didn't even bother to open the office. No one was sending any letters anymore. Then, a couple of months ago, Ali came by with his postcards. Since then, things are looking up. Ali Niali is a former tour guide. He and the other guides can no longer find work guiding tourists along the city's sandy streets. The radical Islamist occupation in 2012 and continued threats put a stop to tourism in northern Mali. But last year, Niali partnered with an American hostel owner in Bamako, Phil Pauleta, to launch the website Postcards from Timbuktu.
For a lot of people, especially in the United States, it's a place that is basically imaginary. It's like this imaginary frontier town on the desert from some ancient time. A lot of people don't know that it's actually a real town, that people live there now.
Timbuktu was founded in the 5th century and was an important desert trading post for centuries. But its location made it hard to reach, and in the Western world it became a metaphor for any distant and mysterious place. Via the internet, customers now tell Niali and the other former tour guides what messages they want written on the postcards. Niali says some cards are love letters from people who feel that because the card is coming from a faraway city, like Timbuktu, it shows the strength of their love. Others are from people who have studied the history of the ancient city and hope to visit but couldn't because of the insecurity. It costs $10 to send a postcard. Half of the proceeds go to Niali and his team of scribes. And over at the post office, Timbuktu's only postman is busier than ever. He says, "Last month I sent over 200 cards. Ali is my most important client. Even if he comes on a Saturday, like today, I'll open the office just for him." The cards help to show Timbuktu is more than a legend and is also open for business. Katerina Heye for VOA News, Timbuktu.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. In soccer at the Rio Olympics, it was South Africa 0, Brazil 0, Nigeria 5, Japan 4, and Honduras 3, Algeria 2. In other news, an official of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition says East African leaders meeting Friday in Ethiopia should endorse an intervention force for South Sudan to complement the UN peacekeeping force already in the country. President Salva Kiir has already said foreign troops are not necessary and their introduction would be a transgression. But Goy Uyoyo, SPLM in opposition representative to Ethiopia and the African Union, says the peace agreement signed last year has collapsed following last month's clashes between rebel and government forces. Former rebel leader and former first vice president Riek Machar was replaced and has since been on the run. Uyoyo says last month's clashes prove that President Salva Kiir is not in control of his forces. That's it for this Friday, August 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you will have a very good weekend.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Padu discusses how athletes prepare both mentally and physically for high-level competition like the Olympics. Our guest is Cameron Myler, four-time U.S. Olympic and Clinical Assistant Professor, Tisch Institute for Sports Management. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
The show.